Turks, Hannah Cranston here with Mark Thompson and Ava Hill making her Young Turks debut. Aww. You guys may recognize Ava from my show. This is a shameless plug. A shameless plug disguised as a plug for Ava. Think Tank, go to youtube.com/thinktank.
That's why Hannah's so you can a success. Find Ava and
I. Well, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here to sit with you guys.
That was shameless. But now I'll give a non-shameless plug as well.
Plug.
You can listen to Mark Thompson's The Edge with Mark Thompson podcast. What's like the most recent episode that you did?
What was it about? Most recent episode is all about a huge Nat Geo series that's coming out called The Long Road Home. It's based on the Martha Raddatz book. Mm. And it's all about a unit in Iraq of American troops that was there just on a peacekeeping mission, so they're really lightly armed, and they were attacked in an ambush by thousands of Iraqi insurgents. It's an amazing. It was called Black Sunday. But anyway, we had the creator of the television series on with us, so you can find it now at edge-show.com. It's called The Edge with Mark Thompson. It's a really interesting conversation. And Michael Shore is on that same episode. We talk politics and we talk kind of what's going on. So there's a little something for everybody.
Oh, I'm definitely going to want to listen to that.
Thank you.
We have a pretty hefty hour for you guys. We're going to start, obviously, talking about the Texas church shooting. But then we have some really interesting things that an Egyptian lawyer said about women who wear ripped jeans. So you're going to want to stay around for that. But now let's jump right in. The Supreme Court ruled in a decision that they announced today that reckless domestic abuse still counts as a misdemeanor of domestic violence, which therefore prohibits you from buying a gun. Now, Justice Elena Kagan, who authored the majority opinion on this, said that a person who assaults another recklessly uses force no less than one who carries out the same action knowingly or intentionally. Now, this decision comes from the case Voisin versus the United States, which was brought about by two men who lost their right to own or buy guns because of histories of domestic violence misdemeanors in the state of Maine. Now, under the Lautenberg Amendment, which Congress passed in 1996, individuals convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors can't legally own or buy guns, but lawyers for the two men argued that their crimes didn't qualify for the federal gun ban because their assaults were committed recklessly as opposed to knowingly or intentionally. All right, so under Maine law, a person who acts recklessly when he or she consciously disregards a risk that the person's conduct will cause such a result. Now, in this sort of case, when we're talking about reckless domestic abuse, it might seem a little bit confusing. Like, what does that mean? And so oftentimes in these sorts of cases, when they're talking about reckless abuse, it's like, oh, the person flew off the handle, they were out of control, they didn't know what they were doing, rather than trying to having sort of like a prior intent to abusing somebody. So it makes sense that this would fall under what a domestic violence misdemeanor looks like, because you were still committing domestic violence even if you were in a frenzy of some sort. Now, this is really important because domestic violence actually is positively correlated with gun violence. Now, experts say that if an abuser has access to a gun, victims are 5 times more likely to be killed. Now, there was a study that was published earlier this year that found that simply living in a state with a high rate of gun ownership increases a woman's chance of being fatally shot in a domestic violence situation. Now, this is particularly pertinent right now because the Texas shooter had a history of domestic violence against his wife. Additionally, many are saying that this might have been motivated because of a domestic situation with his mother-in-law. So obviously right now we are talking about this, but we should have been talking about this all along, because it seems with a lot of these mass shooters, in fact, 1 in 6 mass shooters actually have a history of domestic violence. Everybody from James Hodgkinson, who was the man who shot at Congress at the baseball practice, the perpetrator responsible for Virginia Tech, the perpetrator responsible for Pulse nightclub, the Boston Marathon bomber, even the man who drove into the rally at Charlottesville, all had a history of domestic violence. I mean, this seems like a pretty common theme here. What do you guys think about this?
Yeah, these are not one-offs, you know.
Yeah,
these people all seem to have some sort of background
pattern
that suggests other violence on a perhaps less grand scale, but also on a dangerous scale. And the domestic abuse argument, as well as violence against animals, which is an odd congruence also, that really has been shown to be a sort of a pre-indicator of a possible, shall we say, violent outcome. And now we're seeing with all of these cases, and it's insane, we're talking about in hour one, I mean, all of these mass shootings and mass murders, as the weaponry becomes more sophisticated and more designed to take out more people, these domestic violence correlations of the sort that Hannah's talking about, they really, I think, are a huge cause for concern. And as I say, they might be a predictor of what can happen.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because when you think about it too, it's like if you are willing to inflict harm and inflict violence on somebody who you supposedly love and are in a romantic relationship,
planned or unplanned,
of course you like are also capable of then inflicting some sort of violence on strangers. And so I do think that it is a predictor, right? If you have those sorts of tendencies and if you have that, even that capability, I think that makes sense, unfortunately.
And that one stat, I'm sorry I would jump in, but that one stat I thought was so telling, where that if there's a gun in the home.
Yeah, they're five times more likely. And I'm from South Carolina, so, and people love their gun laws in my home state. So that kind of struck a nerve with me as far as as safety is concerned. But yeah, I think that this is on a right path when it comes to gun laws. And I just don't understand, I guess, why we can't make more sensible laws like this to constrict guns from just, you know, being, you know, in people's homes or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at things that can actually curb mass shootings, right? Like, obviously, universal background checks help. Obviously, you know, looking at in terms of domestic abuse and prohibiting people who have a history of domestic abuse from attaining guns, even though sometimes there are loopholes and they can attain them through, you know, private sellers and things like that. Like, they can all mitigate it to some extent. But when you look at the things that actually curb mass shootings, it's reducing the amount of guns. Like, that's the truth and that's the facts. Like, if you look at, you know, states where they have reduced the amount of guns, then you see that there's a reduction in violence. And so I think this gun violence. And I think that that's a no-brainer. I mean, America has more guns, you know, per capita than any other developed country, and American women are thus 16 times more likely to be shot and killed than women in developed countries. Like, I think this, we need to like look at the numbers here, we need to look at the facts here. And like Ava was saying, is change our laws accordingly. Like, it doesn't make sense that there are more guns. And I understand there's people, just really quick, I understand that there are people who, you know, feel that, you know, for some people in southern states or and rural areas and things like that, that it is a hobby, right? If you are,
it's
part of the culture, whatever.
Yeah.
It's a hobby or something like that, where you want to go out and hunt and things like that. But if I like yoga, if my hobby was killing people, I would say, okay, let's close down some yoga studios. I get it. Do you know what I mean?
With some people, especially being from the South, it's embedded in their culture. And you know, if they're not going out and doing harm, and you know, they don't really see. Ultimately, gun laws will affect everyone. And if they're not doing anything but hunting and not, you know, harming people, then they don't really see why their guns need to be taken for someone else's actions. And so it's just, it becomes like this huge debate as to, well, why does my gun have to leave? You know, I didn't do anything wrong versus, you know,
I understand. I get the logic there, but within a month, essentially, at some point, I understand that you don't want, you know, other people's actions to affect yours, but at some point, like, we have to say enough is enough. People have died that you can give up some of your rights.
And what do you think about this argument that these two men are actually coming forward saying that, well, we acted recklessly and it wasn't planned, so we should, you know, have our gun laws back? What do you think about that? I think that that's a scary debate to have.
Well, domestic violence typically is is a crime or an act of passion, of anger. I mean, it's not premeditated typically. Almost by definition, domestic violence isn't that way. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes alcohol accompanies it, or, mm-hmm. or there's an argument, and then no one anticipated the argument, or if they did, they certainly didn't anticipate that it would end in violence. And I think in this case, that's where this becomes very important, because a lot of people can say, well, look, I want a gun to protect my domicile, my home, whatever. Right. Okay, but there's certainly certain histories that should accept you from being able to own a gun. Right. And domestic violence should be one of those things. That's why those stats that Hannah had mentioned are so important in this conversation. So, yeah, you can have your gun for your home, but if you have a history of domestic abuse, we don't want that gun in the home.
And the fact that this is even being argued is crazy to me. I think that, you know, domestic violence and other tracks of history, they go hand in hand with either owning a gun or not. So I just, you know, I'm for it.
Yeah, I think if you are a perpetrator of violence, like we talked about with animal cruelty,
you should not have
like that. If you are a perpetrator of violence, regardless of what weapon or your hands or, you know, whatever it may be, you should then not be able to. You should not have the access to have some sort of other tool to then perpetrate more violence and more potentially fatal violence. So we'll see. I mean, I'm glad that the justices ruled against that.
Ruled against that.
And I think that's an important ruling, especially right now. All right, moving on. Following the Texas church shooting on Monday, Fox and Friends said that a church is actually the best place to get shot. Take a look.
We've been reporting this shouldn't happen in a church, but I was downstairs talking with some people that work here that we all talk about our faith and we share the same beliefs. We were saying there's no other place we would want to go in that other than church, because I'm there asking for forgiveness. I feel very close to Christ when I'm there. So I'm trying to look at some positives here and know that those people are with the Lord now and experiencing eternity and no more suffering, no more sadness anymore.
Yeah. I literally have no words following that. It makes no sense. I mean, trying to find positives after an event like this is it doesn't make sense. It's illogical. It's insensitive, I think. And I thought what was really interesting when she said that, she goes, no more suffering, no more sadness anymore. And that like makes sense when, you know, your 12-year-old dog is having hip problems and is blind and you put him out of his misery. You're like, you know, there's no more suffering anymore. That makes sense. But for like the healthy and vibrant like 18-month-year-old and the 5-year-old and the 72-year-old, who all the victims of the shooting who went to church on Sunday to go pray and to be with their loved ones and to be part of a community, and then were, you know, a lot like just shot out of for no reason. That's not, they weren't sad. That wasn't like you put them out of their misery.
Yeah, they weren't stage four cancer patients in some ward. Are you kidding? These people were healthy people, and they're in a church. It's absurd. It's offensive. It's absolutely awful. I mean, just when you think that the rhetoric on that show can't get any worse. They serve this unbelievable.
I can't fathom trying to look for a positive in a situation like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's where my mind would go. It's appalling that that was even a comment that was made. I'm wondering if, you know, she'll kind of backtrack what she has stated, if she'll try to apologize.
It's Fox.
Is she?
Not gonna happen.
I'm looking for the positives in this situation. And I'm hoping that she thinks about what she said and says to herself, you know, this isn't really a particular situation where you try to look for the like there are no positives in this situation. You know, lives were being taken, and that's what we need to be focused on and how to prevent that in the future. I mean,
if there's a positive to be had, it would come in the form of a real dialogue and discussion about what we're going to do about this country that has all these semi-automatic weapons, mm-hmm. and they're so easy
and
to get.
And for Fox to have a soul search, because that's a crazy statement.
Yeah, I agree. And so they did try to have a conversation about things that they could implement to prevent something like this. So they actually had on megachurch pastor Robert Jeffress, who talked about implementing policies like no backpacks in church, like he has implemented in his church to prevent acts like this happening. But then he said this.
I heard one report that there were a number of people who were in the church but didn't have the guns with them, because out of respect for the fact that they were going into church, they left their guns in their car. Is that common?
Well, it's certainly not common in our church. I'd say a quarter to half of our members are concealed carry. They have guns, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. They bring them into the church with them.
And so, makes you feel safer.
You know,
yeah.
Well, I think it does. And I think, look, if somebody tries that in our church, they may get one shot off or two shots off, but that's it. And that's the last thing they'll ever do in this life. Yeah.
So let me get this straight. People can't bring in backpacks to his church, but they can all come in weapons. I mean, it makes zero sense. There is no logic behind what he's saying there. And again, he's talking about, like, let's say he has this mega church. You know, there's these mega churches that can fit 16,000 people in it, right? And so if one person tries to fire off one, you know, shot in this entire stadium of a church, and then you have the entire stadium shooting back at him, that's going to cause more fatalities. It makes zero sense. It's just like a stupid statement.
The good guys with guns, or in this case, the good parishioners with guns, will take out the bad parishioner with a gun. Again, as Hannah says, does make no sense. If you'd had it in Las Vegas, you'd have hundreds and hundreds of casualties because you'd have the sound of a bullet, it's ricocheting, and then you just start blowing away. Everybody's getting, and you know, many people aren't trained. They just have a weapon because they think it's cool. I mean, it makes no sense. Yeah, you'd have a big bloody church scene.
Yeah. This actually is a soft spot for me because I'm from Charleston, South Carolina, and that's where the Dylann Roof shot 9 people. And I was home during that time and went to the church the next day. And it's just, I don't know, it makes me feel uneasy that now we even have to question going to church and if it's safe enough. And I've had that thought since that happened in Charleston. It's just, you know.
Yeah, no, so 2 points is I think at this point, honestly, it's you're not safe anywhere. You're not safe
at
elementary
because you never
school,
know what other people
at a church,
have
you're not
on
safe
them.
At a mall, you're not safe at the movie theater, you're not safe anywhere.
Anyway.
So, like, that, pushing that aside, I mean, I think we really need to talk about this sort of argument of, you know, a good guy with a gun. And so, in this scenario, all of these NRA supporters and super conservatives and Second Right Amendment fanatics are you know, reveling in the fact that in this specific case, there was a man who shot the shooter and potentially could have stopped other shootings, right? So they have that to sort of, you know, ride on in this particular case. But as Mark mentioned, that was not the case in Las Vegas. That was not the case in other mass shootings. But I feel like this good guy with a gun, you know, argument has been debunked over and over again, like we've mentioned before, that increase in guns increases in violence, right? And when you look at these sorts of shootings, the underlying of their argument that a good guy with a gun is going to stop a bad guy with a gun has the core of, well, these mass shootings are going to happen anyway, so maybe if we have somebody extra with a gun,
we can
sort of stop some of this. How about if we didn't have all the guns, then we wouldn't have the mass shootings? Like, let's come with a more preventative measure of talking about how we sort of implement these ways to mitigate these mass shootings instead of being like, well, maybe we'll have like one or two less people. Look, less people dying, I'm all for. But at the same time, like if we could stop dying in the first place, let's do that option.
It's a big cultural war. I think that people who, you know, grew up with guns in their home and hunting and all that kind of stuff, we have to be able to come together and really talk about what can we do to better, you know, the safety of everybody. And I think that they're so stuck in their ways of wanting to possess what, you know, what is in their right to that they don't feel like there's a middle ground, and I think that's where
Great, but there is a middle ground, right? So, like, look, like, I'm not trying to take away your Second Amendment right, but then let's implement different things. Like, let's have universal background checks in every single state. Let's also implement, like, training for, you know, gun safety and gun training. I mean, there's so many different states that don't require any sort of training. You can just walk away with a gun. And so maybe you're a good guy who wants to be stop one of these events when it happens, but if you don't have training of how to point, you could kill more people.
Yeah.
I mean, we did a story a few years ago about somebody who was trying in a like a parking lot or something like that, who was trying to stop somebody from running away from stealing, and they just started shooting I mean, they could have killed people.
Oh no, of course. That's what I'm saying. That people aren't really trained to handle a lot of this weaponry, and as the weaponry gets bigger and bigger and more unwieldy, it becomes more difficult to hang on to. And by the way, just speaking of bigger weapons, and you were mentioning hunting, I mean, I can't see ever being a hunter. But all right, so you're a hunter. You're not hunting anything with an AR.
Right,
okay?
Exactly.
I mean, so we've got to put a lid on a lot of this. And while I mentioned that, I'm certain that the Constitution, which again is, we mentioned this in the first hour, I mean, it's a living, breathing document. It can be modified and has been modified, but let's assume that you're taking it the way it is. As it was forged, it wasn't conceived that we'd be dealing with these kinds of weapons.
Right. Well, our society doesn't do well with change, and I've noticed that, especially when it comes to the Second Amendment. I mean, people want their right to possess guns, and that's just that. And once you try to take that away from them, it's messing with their culture. I'm not for this. It's just me being from the South. I kind of not understand, but I can hear what people who want to possess guns would say to this. And, you know, I'm not for it.
But I feel like, I mean, there's so many different arguments where there has been something that is law that we then realize is antiquated and we need to modify it, right? I mean, there's different like cultural aspects. Like if you look at the, you know, for the people who, you know, support these kind of things, you look at the Bible, there's so many laws that we don't follow in the Bible
anymore. So many. And we handpick the ones that we want to follow.
They are antiquated and they don't make sense anymore, right? And we got rid of slavery. That was in law, but
yeah,
that
the South was big on that.
Yeah, that was part of their culture, and we got rid of that because that's fucked up. And so in this sort of case, like, this is effed up. Too many people are dying, so we need to make changes.
But Ava's right. It is a third rail for a reason. People want it.
They want it, and they don't like change, especially in the South.
I want a lot of things.
They love that Second Amendment right. I'm telling you, it's like they, you know, I just feel like with a lot of core Southern, even Republicans, I feel like when it comes to that, they don't want change.
Well, the thing is, though, if you look at specifics when it comes to gun legislation, most Americans support increased laws that would increase safety around guns, right? Background checks,
right.
Reducing military-style weapons and things like that. But when you look at legislation, they often don't vote that way, and people in the GOP don't vote that way because they're lobbied by the NRA. Now,
right. That's a key point. Hannah's right. I mean, by far, overwhelmingly, Americans support restrictions on gun ownership.
Yeah.
And so for all the, they want their guns, their identity is their guns, I get it. But overwhelmingly, Americans are for background checks and for some safety around these weapons. And so the legislators are just bought and sold on this issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. All right, guys, we are going to take a quick break right now. But when we come back, we're going to talk about a woman who was fired for something that I think we would all do. So stick around and we'll be right back. Back on the Young Turks, Hannah, Mark, and Ava. Now, before we jump into our next story, I want to read some of your tweets from hashtag TYT Live. Samantha Willis says, still having a hard time digesting the fact that one of the victims was an 18-month-old. Mm. My daughter is 18 months old. I mean, yeah, this was just a senseless act of violence, and it's tragic. I mean, just as all senseless acts of violence, any act of violence is tragic. But this, I think it's particularly tragic when you see like innocent babies and children. Like that's, I think, what sometimes elicits emotion, which is
why
horrible.
Ainsley's comment was just so out of touch, in my opinion.
Right. Well, and church and children are representative of sort of an innocence and a safety.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so that's why this is all the more shocking. But so is elementary school and children. And Sandy Hook didn't bring about any change.
Right. No, it's a good point. Kara Curley says, sensibility seems to have no place in America. Right now, that does seem to be the case.
Yeah, there's no empathy.
It's hard.
We need to work on empathy for sure.
And Bill Wetzel talking about Pastor Jeffress says, bragging how tough your church is, WTF. Yeah, I mean, we didn't really get into it. Like, that's kind of bizarre.
And it's kind of sad, but I'm already assuming where he's from. I don't know where in particular, but I have
it was profiling up in here.
I am. I mean, listen, coming from the culture, it doesn't surprise me anymore. It scares me.
But it seems weird that you be like preaching, quite literally,
to bring guns in your
sort of like peace and kindness and treat thy neighbor, and then be like,
bring your guns.
We're gonna like shoot some people if they try. Like, it's weird.
Yeah,
it doesn't make sense.
It's so contradicting.
All right, some other things that don't make sense. Next story. The woman in the viral photo of a biker flipping off Trump's motorcade has been fired over the image. Now, this woman is Julie Briskman, who is a 50-year-old mother of two, and she said she was stunned that someone had taken a picture of her giving Trump the middle finger. Apparently, he was driving back from a golf course, and she was along the route, and she said she gave him the middle finger a few times while biking, and the picture was snapped by a White House photographer. It has since gone viral. Now, as the photo circulated online, Briskman decided to tell her company, which seems like a right thing to do, right? Akima. And she told the HR department what was happening. And then she went to work, when she went to work on Monday. Now, by Tuesday, her bosses called her into a meeting and said she had violated the company's social media policy by using the photo as her profile picture on Twitter and Facebook. So the photo goes viral. She makes it her profile picture. Makes sense. She notified her company that it was going viral. There were late night talk show hosts that had talked about it. So she wanted to give them sort of a heads up. Then on Tuesday, they fire her over this photo, right? And in an interview, she said, they said that we're separating from you. Basically, you cannot have lewd or obscene things in your social media. So they were calling flipping him off obscene, essentially, right? Now, Akima said that the photo could hurt their business because they are a government contractor. Unfortunately, that logic didn't seem to hold true in other cases. Now, there was a male colleague that actually kept his job after recently posting lewd comments on his Facebook page that actually featured an Akima LLC as his cover photo. This colleague was reprimanded for calling someone a effing libtard asshole on Facebook, but was allowed to delete the post and kept his job. So it seems like there may be a little bit of a political bias there. And so it seems absurd that he would keep his job for saying that, but then flipping off, you know, Trump's motorcade, that seemed as more obscene and more lewd than using that sort of language online, which is just, I mean, if they do have that political bias, right? If they are lean conservative or lean Republican, it seems sort of antithetical to a lot of the rhetoric that you hear when Republicans are talking, right? They're all like against this PC culture and this and that. And then somebody flips somebody off and they fire over that. It doesn't make sense.
I feel like you can't do anything anymore without without getting fired or having a consequence. I mean, and that's kind of the dangers of social. Hannah knows my take on social media. And you know, there's a lot of perks, but on the downside, if you do something like this, which is freedom of speech technically, and then you put it as your profile picture on Facebook, and then people identify where you work, they kind of go hand in hand. So I don't really agree with her using it as her Facebook photo, but at the same time, it's kind of crazy that she got fired over that.
I think that's exactly right. That you have to say, hey, listen,
I mean, you're asking for it.
You are looking for trouble.
You're looking for trouble.
You're making your profile picture, and then you go to HR and you actually point it out to them, and you might have actually been able to get away with it.
Right, come on.
Although, if you make your profile picture, probably not. But there was nothing in the picture that necessarily indicated who she was, you know? So there could have been a certain amount of anonymity, but clearly she wasn't good with that. She went and
she was proud of what she did. And whatever, that's your business. But then to make it as your, you know, your social identity, it just, and then, you know, what if people go to that business and say, this employee is working there and she did this and this and this, and then it becomes their burden and responsibility. You know what I mean? So I feel like they didn't really have a choice but to do that.
But the last thing on that is on the posting. Is that if you're aware of the culture at your organization,
right,
then you should be aware the kinds of things that you can post on social media.
Exactly.
But having said that, there is clearly the kind of contradiction that Hannah was just outlining, which is, look,
there's I can
call these people effing libtards and get a, and that's not obscene, and you know.
So don't post your occupation.
But real quick, because if we're talking about culture, right? I mean, yes, there's a political aspect to the culture, but if you're looking at the culture of a company and somebody can get away with saying, you know, effing libtard asshole, then you're going to think that this is totally innocuous. I mean, this comparatively is not the same sort of comment.
And, on the obscene scale, it's
not. It was on, yes, on the obscene scale.
And they should have had consequences too, though.
And they said effing libtard asshole on a Black Lives Matter thread. I mean, it seems like that is so absurd and out of line. And I feel a little conflicted, right? Like, I do think that to some extent, like, you should be able to express yourself how you please in your free time, right? If you are on company time, if you are in a business situation, that is another story.
And that's what she said. And this wasn't company time.
Right, this wasn't company time. And so I do think that, I mean, social media complicates it, right? Because people can see where you work, especially with this guy. He had it as his cover photo where he worked.
Yeah, don't post where you work. I mean,
well,
come on.
Well, let's have like a little bit of like freedom of expression.
I mean, I agree with that, but I do feel like she was asking for it in this case. But let me ask a question though. Do you feel like in our society we do kind of base things on our own political views? Do you think that liberals do that as well? Or do you think it's just something that the right does more?
No, I think like in this scenario, if I had seen somebody flipping off Obama or Bernie Sanders
and had their job listed,
I don't think they should be fired. Of course not. I mean, we're gonna get to a story. The next story that we're gonna do is talking about Rand Paul being assaulted. I don't agree with Rand Paul. I don't think he should have been assaulted. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you can disagree with somebody's political opinions, or you can agree with them, or whatever. But like, still, I think there's certain, courses of action that should not take place.
I don't think she should have lost her job. I just think she was kind of inviting
conflict.
She
said she was
it wasn't the smart thing. But,
yeah.
but I mean, to your point though, it's ironic because the side of the aisle that calls out snowflakes all the time for political correctness can't take a little, you know, somebody flipping off the president in traffic.
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, that's snowflake.
And she wasn't doing any harm. I mean, it was clearly just expression.
I mean, you know? I thought it was funny. I when it first broke, I think maybe I tweeted it or liked it or whatever.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was just funny.
She's doing something that a lot of us feel.
Yeah. And plus, I mean, she wasn't, it wasn't a picture of her in front of the White House with some controversial,
right.
So
she wasn't really in the heart
of intense controversy. But I think as we've all now said, you kind of got to know the territory, and her territory was really not so conducive to being
social media.
But they asked your occupation on Facebook.
Yeah, but
they asked where you were.
I don't put it though. I don't put the specifics as to what I do. I say in general what I am, but I don't put like the, you know, specific places that I contribute to, because I just don't want people. It's just too much information. And I feel like if you're an outspoken person and you have social media, there are things, unfortunately, I'm not agreeing with it, but there are things, unfortunately, that you have to do in order to have a safe space for your opinion. Because if you don't do that, then people will disagree with that and they will ultimately fire you, like this woman. You know what I mean? So I have friends who, they don't really put their government name on Facebook. They have another name and they don't put their occupation. And so it's like their free space to, you know, and they know all of their friends, you know, that they have on Facebook, and it's their free space to kind of, you know, say what they want and do what they want. And, you know, I feel like in that right, if that's what you want to do, if you want to have your profile picture like that, then you shouldn't have your occupation under there.
So if she had her profile picture like that, but she hadn't listed her occupation, how would that have changed it? Meaning if she still went to
maybe
HR.
Maybe it would have taken a little longer for them to identify who she was, and then her get fired a month later as opposed to now.
But I feel like,
I don't know.
Look, I think if you are like taking a picture of yourself, like,
listen, I'm not for it. She should have her job.
You know what I mean? Like, that's one thing. But this is like, I mean, look at that. This is the most innocuous.
She's
thing
not harming
anyone.
And you can't even tell who she is.
This is so absurd.
It's not like she's wearing a company jacket. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no, too absurd. All right, moving on. On Friday, Senator Rand Paul was assaulted by his neighbor. And now his attacker may face some pretty serious charges. Now, Doug Stafford, who is Paul's chief of staff, said in a statement on Sunday that the senator has 5 rib fractures, including 3 displaced fractures, meaning that the bones are partly or completely cracked. Paul has lung contusions that are caused by these broken ribs. And his recovery could last several months. Now, these fractures can cause other significant medical problems, including internal bleeding, damage to other organs, or pneumonia. Now, his neighbor, Rene Boucher, is the alleged attacker. And here is a picture of him. Now, he was released Saturday on a $7,500 bond, according to the county jail records. And he is scheduled to appear in court on November 9th. Now, Originally, Boucher's assault was classified as a misdemeanor because there was no sort of weaponry used, right? But the extent of Paul's injuries could prompt prosecutors to charge Boucher with a felony and upgrade it. And additionally, the FBI is actually assisting state and local authorities to see whether there were any violations of federal law. Now, we don't know the impetus of the disagreement or why he assaulted Rand Paul. There are neighbors who are giving anecdotes about how Rand Paul and Boucher were on opposite sides of the political spectrum, although Boucher's lawyer says that the disagreement was not political in nature. Regardless, you know, even if you do disagree with somebody vehemently about politics, this sort of assault is unacceptable. Like, there's no reason to hurt somebody in this way. And so,
by the way, the fact that he could hurt him that much without there being a weapon involved,
right,
I mean, he broke all those ribs. And who is this guy?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, apparently they had some sort of relationship through the medical field. Both were in the medical field in this in their small town, and they were seen with their dogs walking. Like, that's all we know about this. I mean, we'd see them in heated discussions about healthcare. So we don't know a lot. We don't know a lot about his prowess, his physical prowess. We don't know a lot about the catalyst for this disagreement.
It has to be political. I mean,
I don't want to jump to conclusions,
but I feel like.
But I'm jumping.
But I'm gonna jump. I'm gonna go ahead and take the risk here.
You think it's political?
I think that there has to. Yeah, there's some huge disagreement in there that they just couldn't come to terms with, and.
As long as we're jumping, I think somebody's having sex with the other guy's wife. That's what I think. All right.
Thank you for jumping.
All right.
That's how these fights start, you know.
Well, regardless,
I don't have facts.
If there was a political disagreement or if there was an affair, we don't know.
Regardless, though,
people
it
are making. Regardless, it should not have happened. There's no excuse for violence like that. There's no reason for violence like that. I feel for Rand Paul. I feel bad that he's in pain. I feel bad that he suffered these awful injuries. And so, I mean, this is. It'll be interesting to see what happens on November 9th, what charges they file against Boucher, and what happens. So, all right, moving on. Since actor Anthony Rapp came out with sexual abuse allegations against Kevin Spacey, at least 8 more men have come forward, including actor Harry Dreyfuss, who is the son of Richard Dreyfuss. Now, in a BuzzFeed essay, Harry Dreyfuss detailed his experience of being groped by Spacey. When he was 18 years old, he recalled an incident that took place while he was helping his father, the actor Richard Dreyfuss, rehearse for a play at Spacey's London apartment. When it happened, he said that he looked into Spacey's eyes and he gave the most meager shake of his head that he could imagine. He said he was trying to warn him without alerting his dad, who still had his eyes glued to the page. He says, I thought I was protecting everyone. I was protecting my dad's career. I was protecting Kevin, who my dad surely would have tried to punch. I was protecting myself because I thought one day I'd want to work with this man. So this is a great essay and a very brave essay by Dreyfuss. And since this allegation came out from Anthony Rapp last Sunday, all of these men have come out. And this pattern from Spacey seems to date back decades. And so I'm gonna walk you through some of the timeline of the allegations against Kevin Spacey so we can see how long that this has been going on and the pattern, okay? So in 1983, an anonymous man told New York Magazine that when he was 14 and Spacey was 24, he began a sexual relationship with Spacey that allegedly culminated in Spacey attempting to rape him. He said that he tried to end the relationship when somebody said that, hey, this is not normal for a 14-year-old to have a relationship with a 24-year-old man. In 1985, Spacey allegedly approached an anonymous 17-year-old boy, befriending the teen and then ultimately inviting him to visit his home, where Spacey progressed from being charming and brotherly to sexually inappropriate. After rejecting Spacey's initial advances, the accuser says he woke up to find Spacey's head on his stomach and his arms wrapped around him. Justin Dawes told BuzzFeed that he met the 29-year-old Spacey in 1988 through a Connecticut theater when he was 16 years old and a junior in high school. Spacey allegedly invited Dawes and a friend to hang out at his apartment where he served them cocktails and played gay porn. In 2003, director Tony Montana alleges that Spacey approached him in a bar, groped him, and said, "This designates ownership." As he did so, Mexican actor Robert Cavazos tells a similar story of being groped, and that Spacey would actually grope multiple men at Old Vic's bar. And these stories go on, and they all seem to, up until now, we covered last week that multiple anonymous cast and crew members on the set of House of Cards have come forward about inappropriate behavior from Spacey. So this is going up until now, till 1983, for all that we know. We don't know if there's going to be more allegations that come out. But what seems clear is that this was happening. Unfortunately, a lot of people knew that it was happening, and Spacey thought that he was untouchable. When in this article that I implore you guys all to read on BuzzFeed from Harry Dreyfuss, he details Spacey's audacity in doing this with his father sitting right there. He was like, he knew that he was untouchable, that I wasn't going to say anything and nothing was going to happen to him. And this is a common theme with all of these men in power who perpetrate this. They do not think that they are going to be touched. And finally, following this Weinstein scandal, finally, it is judgment day and these men are coming down one by one. It's just...
Yeah, I think the striking thing about the is really striking, and I think you touch on it so well, Hannah, at the very end, your final point. This Harry Dreyfuss, the son of Richard Dreyfuss, you see how he's conflicted, because on the one hand, he wants to say something, do something, protest. But on the other hand, he's aware of the fact and conscious of the fact that his father depends on this guy. He depends on this guy, Kevin Spacey. And there's a professional relationship that he's trying to protect, because he knows if he makes too big a deal of this, it could be ruined by him making too big a deal of it. And you see in that the same problem that women have had with all these powerful men. They want to do business with these men. They want to advance in their careers. They don't want it to be the end of their career. And Harvey Weinstein actually literally threatened, "I'll ruin you. You'll never work again if you don't do that." And that was sort of both implied and explicitly stated. So you see... now in this man-on-man type situation, the very same dynamic that we saw played out with the powerful man and young woman.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to know that it is because of a power dynamic. And oftentimes when these sorts of cases happen, it's like, oh, I'm going to go seek sex therapy and I'm going to, help my sex addiction and things like that. It's not about sex. It's about a power dynamic. And there's a power dynamic here that these people think that they are untouchable and can do whatever they want because they know that they can exert some sort of control over these people's careers, and especially in a career like and in an industry like Hollywood, where you can be sort of blackballed and be
because it's all about relationships,
right? It's about connections and things like that. And they are using that and capitalizing on that
because they know that you need a job. Me being an actress myself, I just I can understand how women felt probably intimidated in that moment to say, what do I do? He's Harvey Weinstein or he's Kevin Spacey and I want this job. So what do I do? Do I say something? Because then that'll hurt me and my career. Will it? Will people be on my side? There's a lot of things that you have to think about before coming out. And so that's why I think it's such a brave move to do so. And it's also a snowball effect too.
In your meetings and castings, has there ever been anything that has sort of approached this sort of weird place where you go, this isn't necessarily as straight as I want it to be?
Not to the extreme of that, but I think sometimes there is like a little room for some unprofessionalism that I've kind of gone home like, did that happen? But nothing to that extreme at all. Fortunately, I haven't had many issues in that department, but.
Yeah, honestly, you're using the right word there. The operative word there is fortunately, right? The truth of the matter is the majority of women have experienced
sexual harassment. Because I feel like no matter what industry.
And sexual abuse, and we're seeing, and additionally that young boys, I believe it's 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before they're at 18, before the age of 18. And so this is happening, and it's about getting like having like
recognition,
yeah. having consequences for their actions. Now that people are seeing that there are consequences to your actions, you will lose your job, you will lose your company, you will lose your entire life because of these sorts of actions. Where previously, you know, if there were rumors, oh, he said, she said, oh, she wanted it or whatever, it was consensual. But now it seems to be, unfortunately, it seems to be, you know, profitable, and it seems to be in the best interest of these companies to completely dissociate with these characters, which I think is a really good shift in our culture. And so we're seeing that with Kevin Spacey. Everybody is cutting ties with him, from Netflix to the theater that he worked at. So I hope that other men look at these sorts of consequences and recognize that this is not okay. I mean, it shouldn't take consequences to know that. It should just be like, I don't know, a moral compass.
But in the past, and for decades, they protected these powerful people because it was of money, it was profit. That was the only reason. Kevin Spacey was profitable. Kevin Spacey's company was profitable. It's Weinstein, same story. And now, perhaps, as they see themselves vulnerable from a profit standpoint, that is going to change.
Money is the driver in this case. And at this point in time, money is on our side. All right, guys, that is the end of our show today. We are going to come back with our last clip for those of you that are watching on YouTube. And then for the members, we will also have a post game. Thanks so much for tuning in. All right, back on the Young Turks, we are going to jump right into this last story. An Egyptian lawyer has some pretty interesting opinions about women who wear ripped jeans. In fact, he thinks that men have a national duty to rape them. All right. Now, in a TV show, he was on a panel, this lawyer, Nabi Al-Walsh, and they were discussing a bill that's trying to crack down on prostitution in Egypt. Now, somehow the conversation turned to women who wear ripped jeans. And in response, Nabi Al-Walsh said, "Are you happy when you see a girl walking down the street with half of her behind showing? I say that when a girl walks about like that, it is a patriotic duty to sexually harass her and a national duty to rape her." Okay? Now, this is not the first time that ripped jeans have entered the cultural zeitgeist in Egypt. Now, in fact, Dean Tarek Sarur of the University of Alexandria's Faculty of Agriculture banned female students from wearing ripped jeans on the college's campus a little over a month ago. Now, he defended the ban to Egyptian newspaper Al-Masri Al-Yum by arguing that revealing clothing, such as ripped jeans, could stir up feelings among young people and may cause sexual harassment incidents. Now, I think this is absurd. I think it's notions like that that actually cause sexual harassment, when you blame the woman and what she's wearing, that are actually the impetus for sexual harassment. And Egypt has a huge problem with sexual harassment and sexual abuse. Now, a Thomson Reuters Foundation poll released earlier this month ranked Cairo as the most dangerous megacity for women, citing exposure to verbal and physical harassment. And a 2013 study from the United Nations reportedly found that 99.3% of Egyptian women had been victims of sexual harassment. 99.3. And when you hear sort of this sort of rhetoric of blaming the woman, or saying that if a woman is showing any skin, that it's your national duty to rape them, then these kinds of numbers aren't surprising. Horrifying, but not surprising. I mean, this is such a disgusting story. What do you guys think about it?
I mean, people's feelings have nothing to do with what I choose to wear. So it's not my fault that you're getting aroused that I chose to wear jeans with my thigh cut. I mean, I feel like I shouldn't have to tailor how I'm dressing for someone else's feelings. Do you know what I mean? It's not my responsibility. And if I'm not coming forward in that way to want anything, I shouldn't be having to tailor myself for the possibility of what that could do to others.
So I have two points in response to that. The first being that I think that we sexualize women's bodies too much, that somehow conflating a woman showing skin with that being sexualized, I think is problematic. I don't think that makes sense, right? I think the second component of that is for these men, right, who were saying like, I'm on TV and I'm powerful and, you know, this culture of machismo and things like that, to feel like you have no power over your impulses is pretty weak frankly. Yeah. If you were going to say that, oh, men, you know, men don't have the power. If they see a woman showing skin, then, you know, they're going to rape her, sexually harass her or whatever. That doesn't seem strong to me. That seems very weak. And so I think that's offensive to a lot of men who are somehow these, like, you know, animals who can't control their impulses. It's also, it's offensive to men as well. I think it's a, you know, a really poor argument that simultaneously, you know, victim blames women, but also says that men are not in control of their emotions or their feelings or whatever it may be, even if they do choose to sexualize a woman's body in the way that we're talking about.
Of course, you're right. I mean, but where you're wrong is just that the logic is so not the way to make the argument. In other words, of course you're right. They're doing the if you pursue the logical argument, it makes no sense. So yeah, the logical argument is just there to, in some way, they're trying to assign or kind of hang a horrible action on the victim, as you say. They're blaming the victim. So pay no attention to what they're talking about and the way they blame the victim. It's just a way they can get themselves off the hook for these horrible things that they've done. So I wouldn't even dignify it with the logic makes no sense, because it is just another way they're trying to farm out this horrible thing that they do. Yeah. I mean, and advocating for the rape of these women, I mean, it's beyond even, I mean, it feels like what like some talk show host in a movie would say to get calls, you know what I mean, on the radio.
Right.
It's so awful.
And inciting this sort of violence, essentially. I
mean, right.
How
it
do you
is
pronounce
violence, yeah.
It's just disturbing.
The lawyer's name?
Awash.
Awash. Okay, so there was a quote that I was just so disturbed by, and he said, if you're a woman who's ever walked down the street wearing a pair of ripped jeans, you deserve to be sexually assaulted and harassed at least.
Yeah.
And that really troubled me. I mean, the fact that two words, deserve and at least, like those are the least of the things that should happen if a woman chooses to wear ripped jeans or whatever.
Right, right. And I agree with what you're saying, Mark, because I do think it's really important to point out, like, this is the complete extreme of rape culture, right? I mean, this is just like such an absurd example of it that sort of illustrates how some may think about things in Egypt, right? And in Cairo. And I mean, clearly that has manifested in some of the statistics that I read you earlier. But I do think what you were saying, you know, about me sort of, you know, almost legitimizing what he's saying by going through the logic of it, I do think that's really important to point out, because I think there's aspects of rape culture and the extent of rape culture and sexual harassment and things like that that are so ingrained that even we can be sort of guilty of sometimes. I mean, even when we're talking about these sorts of scenario and we're saying, you know, this 99.3% of Egyptian women have been victims of sexual harassment. You know, 1 in 5 women in America will be, you know, sexually assaulted or sexually abused. We need to be talking about, you know, how many men are perpetrating this. Not again, I mean, even those sorts of statistics are talking about the victim and putting the onus on the victim. We need to switch the way, we need to switch our verbiage, we need to switch the way that we talk about this and talk about the perpetrators and the criminals who are enacting these crimes and enacting these assaults. I mean, we really do need to change the way that we talk about it. And it's so ingrained that even I become guilty of it, right? Even I am, like, you know, trying to walk through the logic of this complete crazy person who, you know, just spews this disgusting and violent rhetoric. And I say, you know, this many women have experienced this, this many women have experienced this. And I mean, it's the same thing with the Me Too and switching it to, like, hashtag him though. I mean, it's really, we really need to talk about the people that are perpetrating these, not necessarily the victims.
Well, that's a really great, would never have thought of that, so it's really great to hear. I think that when I hear the percentages and the number of women who are victimized there or in any situation, it does bring home to me how big a problem it is. But you're right, to somehow orphan the part of the question that has to do with the perpetrators is wrong. There should be more discussion of that. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, guys, that is our show for today. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you tomorrow.